Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here just a couple of days past the summer solstice here in the Northern Hemisphere. And here in Sitka, we are sitting at almost 18 hours of daylight. We're down just about 20 seconds, I guess, from the solstice today. We're losing 14 seconds, and tomorrow we'll lose another 23 seconds. So slowly starting to accelerate that daylight loss. It'll be a while yet, I'm sure, before we notice it. It seems like usually August before I go suddenly, oh, it's getting dark. It's a great time of year to be out and enjoying the full days, long days. It seems like I don't sleep as much in the summertime, probably in part due to the sunlight out there. And hope you're getting the chance to get out there and enjoy it. And if you're seeing anything of interest, I'd love to hear about it. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I originally recorded and aired back in spring of 2019. It's with Kathy Hawker, a naturalist and artist who is in town doing an artisan residence program at the elementary school. I enjoyed speaking with her about her approach to art and the natural world and the ways that art can help us better see and understand the world around us. So I hope you enjoy this conversation.
I think that drawing is a really good tool for learning about science of any sort. And so it's a kind of a nice interaction, a nice integration of science and art. So,
yeah. Yeah, it is interesting how, like, I haven't done a lot of sketching myself, but the way that it makes you see things or pay attention, I guess, mm-hmm. it helps, it seems like, tune your awareness and your attention. Because I heard you on the radio this morning mm-hmm. speaking a little bit about the images or the symbols essentially that mm-hmm. we have in our mind. I think you mentioned especially a leaf. And so mm-hmm. like all of us probably have some sort of icon mm-hmm. essentially of a very simplified, but that's what leaf means to us.
Yeah.
And maybe that interferes with what we're actually seeing mm-hmm. if we don't like step away from that sort of imagery a little bit.
Yeah, that's kind of the heart of it. I think we're really swimming in symbols and mm-hmm. in our culture, and that's great. I mean, it's lovely that we can use those. They're really powerful things, but they can also, they get in the way of, we make this assumption that we know what something looks like.
Yeah.
In fact, one of my best pieces of drawing advice I ever heard from an instructor for drawing from observation, you know, mm-hmm. drawing from true to life, was draw what you see, not what it is.
Yeah,
that's a good thing to keep in mind.
So how is it? You know, I suppose for a lot of folks, especially if they're coming at it from not being kids, and kids are used to being incompetent. Really, I mean, they're just used to learning everything, and so they don't really care. Especially as they're young, they don't care if they're not any good at something, right? They don't. That's not an issue.
Yeah, or may not have the be at the point where they're seeing the differences mm-hmm. between the drawing and what they're looking at, or not quite looking as closely. Or the other thing, I think kids are really good at recognizing successes, looking at something they've drawn, and up to a certain age, I feel like we are all really good at seeing what's right.
Yeah.
And then for some reason, there's this point at which we start seeing what's wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a sad spot in some ways.
I know. Yeah, it's adults don't like to be bad at things.
Yeah.
Is so many of us, you know, mm-hmm. and it can be really powerful to embrace and accept to just, because the fact is, you probably will learn it faster than a child would, because mm-hmm. a child's learning an immense number of things. Mm. But it's that barrier of feeling really bad at something. And are there things that you know, I don't know if you work with adults very often or older mm-hmm. kids that maybe have already started to feel like, oh, I can't do this because mm-hmm. I'm bad at it.
Sure.
Ways to sort of start to practice in a way that maybe can invite the enjoyment of doing it at whatever level that, you know, you're currently seeing and able to do it.
Yeah, I think if you go into it, I do work with a lot of adults, and I think I always try to first tell people, so A, just doing this is a really brave thing, so you gotta congratulate yourself for even doing it, even picking up the pencil and doing it. You got a blank piece of white paper, it's flat, and you're trying to draw something that's three-dimensional, it's got movement, it's got life, it's got spirit, you know, that's courageous. So, you know, give yourself credit for that to start with. And then second thing, remember, you can just turn the page. You know, and I really encourage people to keep sketchbooks, because then you've got a record of your learning. You can always go back. And, you know, if you hate it, you just always take the page right out and use it for kindling or whatever. But even just the act of drawing is going to take you further along in understanding and learning something. Drawing is a very... it's really a mindfulness exercise. It's a meditation. You're got to be present when you do this kind of drawing. So, yeah, I guess that's where I usually start. Is mm-hmm. you know, give yourself permission to try it, give yourself credit for trying it, and just stick to it for a while, and look for the successes. And that's the hardest part. Just teach yourself how to look. One thing, a physical thing you can do is I teach people to cover parts of the page until. You know, sometimes you're looking at it and it's not looking right. Well, take a piece of paper and just cover parts of the page until at some point you're going to say, oh, actually, okay, that looks okay. And then that helps you narrow down, well, what is it that's bothering me? What is it that's working? So it's hard, yeah.
And I guess, you know, some styles, just from seeing other people's stuff, people that have spent a lot of time and have developed a lot of skill, like it isn't all... And most of it's not even remotely photorealistic.
No.
And some of it's not even especially realistic. I mean, it's very, very clearly interpreted through a personal artistic lens, maybe.
That's a great way to put it. Actually, one time I worked with a nature writing group, and I was doing nature drawing associated with nature writing. And I had never until that moment thought about what the word draw. It has a lot of different meanings, and one of the meanings, is one of the senses of the word draw, is to pull something or pull something through, drawing water through a well, drawing water through a pipe. And so then I started thinking of it, okay, so I'm drawing whatever it is, the tree, say. I'm drawing that tree in my eyes. I'm drawing it through my mind. I'm drawing it down my arm, and it's flowing out onto the paper. And that metaphor really helped me to kind of realize what nature drawing is. It's nature drawn through a person. And when it comes out, it's going to be affected by you. And so it's going to be different regardless of, or depending on whoever did it.
And so I suppose, you've done some technical scientific illustration. And I suppose the intent of that is to capture, you know, technical scientific detail that's important for identification or for whatever. But when you're doing, say, a natural history, like if you're just carrying your sketchbook and you're out enjoying yourself, really, just kind of seeing what you see, that the process there maybe is different. What you're trying to capture is like, I mean, I guess what is it that you're trying to capture? Mm. Is it your experience? Is it sort of something that resonates with your experience and kind of captures that feeling in that moment that when you look at it later, you kind of that comes back to you a little bit? Or
and I think that quality is really ends up kind of just being inherent in the sketchbook page. For me, anyway, when I page back through my sketchbooks, I can look at an image. There's one great example I did, almost 20 years ago when I was in a graduate program in science illustration. And it's down in California, Santa Cruz area. We were up on a hillside, and we had been assigned to choose a plant, focus on that plant, and just spend the afternoon drawing it. Just do a very detailed, drawing the whole plant and then details of different parts, looking at different, the buds and the flowers and so on. So I chose this little wild morning glory, and I'm busy working away on that. And I was drawing the flower, and just it was so frustrating to me. It just kept getting more and more frustrating. My drawing was just not right, and I could not figure out what was going on until I noticed that it was starting to get cooler, and the fog was moving in, and what was happening was the flower was closing, but it was closing so slowly I couldn't see the change happening, but it was getting more and more different from my drawing. So I can look back at that page, and I can still feel that frustration. I can feel the fog, the cool of the fog rolling in. I would say that it's just kind of inherent in the process that experience gets captured. It's like a touchstone for your memory on there.
It reminds me, one of the things that I've heard about from is a routine that a person can practice for like nature connection and stuff, and that's you know, I've heard called the storyteller's mind, essentially. Hmm. When you're telling a story, and the way it's described is that when you're going to tell a story, you practice this as a routine, and if you get good at it, then of course then you get, like anything, it's a skill that you can develop. But but you do your best to actually bring, like, call back within you all of the full, like, so the frustration, the all of those things, that whatever story it is that you're telling, you know, the sense of wonder or surprise or all of that. And you may not actually say it in your storytelling, but that feeling is kind of the basis within you. Like you have one person described it as sort of having a foot in both places, right? So in the moment where they're telling the story, they're also keeping that foot in that experience.
Sure.
And that full, like, the more that you can bring to it of your experience, sensory, experience and just the feelings and everything. Hmm. And so that's what I was reminded of a little bit when you're talking about this image, like the mindfulness, as you said, that you have when you're drawing there. That seems like that's part of capturing that sort of and recording that internally in some way.
I think that's a good way to put it. I think those experiences where we're really mindful, regardless of how we are, whether it's drawing or meditation, for some reason, those feel like they're a little more concrete, a little more easy to put your foot into, maybe. Mm-hmm.
It is, it's just kind of an interesting thing. And I don't know, like, when you're sketching, I suppose it depends on what you're sketching, but like sometimes you're sketching just for yourself, I imagine, and other times you're sketching with intent for other people to look at or appreciate in some level. And are you, like, when you sketch things that way, are you intending to evoke something in other people, something in particular, or is it, like, how does that work?
Ooh, good question. Huh. You know, actually, I would say yes, sometimes I am. Especially talking with kids, kind of distinguishing between what is a science illustration and what is a field sketchbook. And they're, you know, kids, sometimes it's a little hard to, what's the difference there? The way I try to convey it is a science illustration is a picture that I do to teach someone else about science. So it's about you. It's about other people. A field sketchbook is a picture I do to teach me about something. So it's about what's going on inside. But I have done that little jump, that bridge, in my own work. I did a little experiment a few years ago. I got a grant from the JAC in Juneau, the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council, to take what I loved about my sketches, which is that kind of immediacy and that moment, that mindfulness moment that just doesn't convey when I do a final illustration. It's lost somewhere along the process. But I wanted to keep that and make an artwork out of it. So I got this grant. I got a whole bunch of big canvases. I made big canvases, and I took great big paint brushes and sepia paint, and I did these gigantic sketch pages, and added... I add a lot of notes to my field sketches. And so I did the same thing with these, but I tried to move it a little more towards a more poetic approach to it. So it was a really interesting experience because those were about me trying to take that field sketching mindfulness moment to somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's exactly, I had never thought of it the way you said it, but but yes, that's what I was doing.
And so just so people know, I have seen some of your field sketch things on your web blog, you update from time to time. Is it Alaska time Sketchbook, I think?
It is. It's Alaska Sketchbook. It's WordPress.
Okay.
If you go to WordPress, it's
AlaskaSketchbook.wordpress.com, probably.
Yes, yeah. I believe that's what it is.
And I'll try, and when I post this show on my website, I'll try and put a link there.
Yeah, put a link there. I need to update it, but
yeah.
I will.
Well, it seems like I've seen you have updated it this year.
I have.
Because I remember seeing sketches of a school. And it's like you say, that there's the sketch, and it seems like often there's a little context or sub-sketches around, and then you know, maybe details or and then notes and questions, like questions that you're asking yourself as you're observing these things. And a little reflection often, it seems like, is there as well.
Yep, and that's partly because I like to encourage that in kids and adults that I teach, but it's also a practice I like to keep for myself. You know, I ask people to to ask themselves the sort of three major categories of questions. You know, what do you observe? That's things, you know, you sense with your senses. What do you think? That's inferences or connections or predictions. And then what do you wonder? So those three categories, I kind of encourage people to add notes.
No, that makes sense. I suppose some of the things that you find evoke sort of emotion as well. Mm. Is that something that you try and capture in there as well?
But maybe I should.
Well, I just wondered.
Yeah.
So how does this
make you feel?
Because, you know, I don't know. Like, I guess, sometimes I suppose, like, if you find, a site where an animal was killed, for example, you know, it's like there's different points of view, right? Somebody was happy because they got to eat. Somebody was very sad because they aren't anymore.
Right.
I mean, at least if we project onto them sort of our own feelings. And so, that's just something that I'm curious about. And, and I've been hearing about that in the context of, like, listening to the birds. And so coming to understand and interpret a bird language, essentially, that if you attend to how it makes you feel, like when a bird's alarming, like you actually have the ability to feel like the agitation that a robin, for example, if a raven's around about to get in its nest. A couple of years ago, we had a robin nesting in the tree right outside our, like, a second story window. We could see the nest. And for a couple of years, I'd been hearing these robins give these aerial predator alarms, which is just a high kind of tss. And I was like, I kept looking around for hawks. I'd read that they're aerial predators. And I was like, well, I mean, I don't see hawks here very often. And I would never see a hawk. And I finally made the connection. Oh, it was the ravens. Like, there was always ravens around. And it was always during nesting season that I heard this. And so the robins are nesting around the neighborhoods. And they would be giving this call. And there'd be like a raven up in the tree. And so I had noticed this for a while. And then this one year, and I sat and... And then suddenly I looked up and the raven was in the nest, and it was like less than a minute. And
the nest ate
everything that was in the nest, all the babies. But the robins were just so upset. And even after the raven was gone, you know, they were still carrying food around and you know, and it was this really traumatic thing for them, I'm sure. You know, I'm not the most, empathetic of people, I suppose. I've never been accused of being overly empathetic. That was obvious enough even for me to sort of like get the sense of agitation. And so that's one of the things I've been, I guess, trying to work on is just like when you're hearing these things or observing them, you know, what is it that like that you're feeling in it? And trying to understand what that's telling, you know, what that's communicating to us.
So what do you think about song? Bird song, because one of the things you often hear bird song and people talk about it as being a joyful sound.
Yeah.
But I've always wondered about that because it's not, the purpose doesn't seem like it would be conducive to joyous feelings. I don't know. What do you think?
Because there's the dawn chorus, right? So sometimes it seems like there is a certain amount of just singing to greet the day and exuberance for life kind of thing. But sometimes it very much is a, you know, this is my spot. And I don't know. Sometimes I think even songs, like in the wintertime, you'll hear a wren sing every once in a while, just like a little short snippet. And I've heard that could be an alarm call. Like that could be a form of an alarm.
Because
you don't really hear it in any consistent fashion. And I heard that from somebody else about not Pacific wrens that we have here, but it was a different kind of wren. And he was curious about that, and he started like paying attention to it, and it actually found out that it was an alarm call. So it was an out of season song, and it would the wren would sing that like when a fox would walk by or something like that. I mean, we don't have foxes here in Sitka, but that wren in that place, which was somewhere in the lower 48, that's what was apparently going on was something like that. And so like I don't know, but it's fascinating to me, you know. It's interesting how much information is just being conveyed back and forth between the different species. And you know, I read about studies of the chickadees, and like the number of D's at the end of their call will indicate the nature of the alarm, you know, the predator.
Like
more intense
prairie dog type.
Yeah, if it has more D's at the end, D D D D D, that's a more scary predator, essentially.
Is that the chestnut backs here? Or
I think I can't remember if that was specifically chestnut backs or if it was like black cap chickadees somewhere else.
Huh.
Another recent study that I just read, which I thought was really interesting, it was about a chickadee relative in Japan, and I can't remember the name of the specific species. Mm. But apparently, like, they discovered that there was like one call that indicated birds to come here, and another call was like, be careful, like, watch out. And if you played them in one order, they would respond to it. Like, they would come over, but with, like, they would watch out, and then they would come over.
Wow.
If you played it in the other order.
Syntax.
Yeah, essentially, there was a certain grammar there. And if you played it in the other order, then it was just like, that didn't communicate to them. And I guess if you played them separately, they would just do the one thing or the other thing. You know, it was a newspaper article about the study. So, you know, it's just the number of things that if we paid attention, and it's difficult, you know, because it's hard to see, like around here, especially they're all up in the trees but for me, it's like you say, what do you wonder about? It's that sense of wonder that you bring to it. I think that is, you know, you just. So much stuff going on. And the more of us that are out there looking and wondering, then, you know, the more that we sort of collectively collectively learn.
Yeah, definitely.
Huh. So, yeah, kind of fun. And I know that, you know, in addition to your illustrations, you've done some field work, I guess, maybe is one way to put it.
Sure.
You worked with Mary Wilson quite a bit on, is she still doing the Dipper research, or is that kind of wound down? Or
it's still just kind of casual observations more than formal research. But
you worked with her on the American Dipper sort of surveys and over a number of years, I guess.
Yeah.
Are they still seeing, I guess you probably wouldn't in Gustavus, but are there any banded birds still around?
Yeah, we haven't seen a banded bird for many years.
Okay.
We actually had the record we had in our study was a 7-year-old bird. Yeah, she was a female, blue, white, red. And she was over on Salmon Creek. She had been banded in a previous study. In the study that we were working on, we resighted her. And actually, I believe she nested for a couple summers and then we lost her. We never found her. Vanished the way they do.
Would they pretty much go to the same reach of stream every summer?
Yeah, actually they were really strong fidelity to nest sites overall. And even to the same nests, literally the same nests sometimes. But there were some places where it would be the same cliff, but they'd be building new nests each time.
Well, I noticed, not too many years ago, the bridge over Indian River was replaced, a main road bridge. And so now underneath it are these large concrete I-beams.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've been over by there.
I was over there snooping the other day.
Yes.
I was thinking, I wonder if they've nested. It feels a little high to me.
There's two nests under there.
Are there really?
Yeah.
Oh, I missed them then.
Yeah, if you
come
from downstream and you look up, there's one in the middle, like in the middle, on the middle I-bar. Both of them are facing downstream.
Ah.
And it was used 2 years in a row. Mm-hmm. And then the next year, the third year, which I think was last year, they moved to a different I-beam.
Okay.
And they built another nest.
Nice. Oh, that's so cool.
I assume it was the same birds.
So the middle
bridge
and it's in the middle beam.
Yeah, it's if you go under, so you can walk up along the river from the park. And so if anybody wants to see this, it was actually kind of fun to observe them. Mm-hmm. And they're probably, if they're going to reuse it, they're probably getting started around now.
There is a pair down there. I did see them. I didn't see the nest. But it was just upstream of the footbridge 2 days ago.
Oh, okay.
And they were definitely very affiliative. They were working together there.
Yeah, and so they would probably, because I think a lot of them have already moved upstream to wherever they go for the summer. Very warm, and I mean, I guess it's not even April yet, but almost April. By the time this airs, it'll be April, just barely. If you go and you look, and I think it's the third I-beam, right in the middle of the river, like halfway across, and there's one just, you know, I guess it's the classic dipper nest, you know, big
dome
Of moss with a hole in the middle.
Excellent.
And then the last one on the upstream side.
Okay.
Again, they're on the downstream side of the I-beam,
but
it's the last, it's the most upstream I-beam. And then there's the second one up there, and that one looks a little fresher, I think. I looked at it recently again. It seemed like it still had a little more fresh. And I don't know how they, have you looked at the nests pretty closely? How do they... structure? I mean, like, what's giving it structure there?
It's pretty much all moss. The dome part is, and it's a variety of moss species. Actually, Ellen Anderson over in Juneau did a whole study of the mosses that was in the Dipper Nest. I don't remember them now, but it was a big range. They are definitely, there's weaving involved to hold that moss together, because they hold together pretty well. I actually salvaged one from a spot in Juneau where it looked really unlikely that they would ever use it again, because people were literally walking right in front of it and they abandoned it. So it seemed like it would be okay to salvage it. So I was able to pick it up, and you could pick it up with one hand and it would hold together. It even had a little, you know, a nest lining. So they build the dome of moss, and then there's a cup that's made of grasses. Often has blueberry leaves in it, which I think is really interesting. I don't know what the blueberry leaf does, and little shreds of bark. And that's inside. It's a pretty skookum little structure.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. It fascinates me that it's not like they have thumbs, right? So they're somehow they're doing this with, yes. I don't know if they maybe they use their feet a little bit or
I
what,
wonder,
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Mostly bills.
Mostly what I've seen nest building is kind of after they get the dome started and you see them disappear with moss inside.
Okay.
And so who knows, but they spend quite a bit of time in there, so they must be doing some kind of.
So they build it from the inside, mostly from the inside?
My understanding from what I've seen and read, I've never witnessed this, is they kind of build it up and around and then start from the inside kind of working outward as well, maybe pushing some parts outward and maybe weaving as well from the inside.
That's pretty amazing that they can do that at all. And I guess a lot of times, I mean, they nest in those places. I've also seen a nest where it was right along the river and kind of a little bit of an overhang, and they actually went up underneath like roots, and I guess they probably just tucked something in there.
Yeah, there are some, that seemed to us that we were looking at that might have even not had much moss at all. Mm-hmm. It's more of a cavity nest than a moss dome nest. There are some really interesting ones in Juneau. Sometimes they'll nest in a boulder pile, and they'll nest so close to the water level that it's just amazing. It doesn't get flooded.
Yeah.
And we had some that the water literally would cover during high waters sometimes, and they successfully fledged chicks from those nests.
Oh, they were getting flooded even during the nesting season?
So somehow probably what was going on was there was they were up in far enough that the water was sheeting over them somehow.
Oh, okay.
It was a little hard to tell, but there was one that we actually had to, we checked these for nest linings because in many cases the dippers would remove the nest lining after a first brood, probably because of nest parasites like bird blowflies. Parasitic insect, and so we would, reach inside and check for the lining. In one place we had to wade into about chest deep water, and then I had to snake my arm up in among some boulders. I couldn't even see the nest. But what was really interesting to me was I could feel the where the cup would have been, and there was this pile of it felt like powder, just a super dry powder. So it obviously did not flood in there. And I pulled out a handful of it, and I think what it was the dust of the sheaths of the pin feathers as they get, crumble off and the feathers emerge. And I think the dippers had been nesting in there so long that it had accumulated this big pile of pin feather sheath dust. It was just amazing.
Wow. Yeah, that is, did you ever document different dippers using the same nests as other ones before, or were they always the same dippers using the same nests?
No, I believe we did see that several times, and sometimes it would be a banded member of the pair that had nested there the year before with a new mate.
Okay.
I'm trying to think if we ever saw two brand new dippers in the same nest. Certainly in the same nest site that would have happened. But yeah, it's a good question.
I mean, I suppose dippers have a certain set of constraints that they're working within that they find to be good habitat or good nest area, and so that there's going to be some overlap, one would think, in general.
Yeah, well, like I said, I was looking under Indian River Bridge there, yeah. and the road bridge. And, it, you know, I probably didn't look as carefully as I should have because it felt too high. It looked too high for me. It didn't seem like the bridge nest that we'd seen in Juneau. So that's pretty interesting to know.
It would be, you know, I hadn't really thought about that, but it is, you know, it's probably, what, 15 feet at least.
Yeah.
And I hadn't really thought about the first time that they come out of that because I guess they're probably, I mean, at that point, they probably have feathers. Mm-hmm. And so they can probably, like, flap their wings and slowly. And I guess if they splash into the water, they're probably little fuzzballs anyway. So yeah, it's probably not a real big impact.
But. Kind of a controlled tumble from what I hear. I've never actually witnessed come out for the first time.
Yeah.
They will go back into the nest that the fledgies will go back into the nest at night sometimes, and so you'll see them come out again.
So they can fly. When they first leave, they are able to fly. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I never saw one freshly emerge to know for sure, but within a very short time, they can fly.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty interesting. I suppose a more dedicated observer of dippers would have camped out there practically. I would go down from time to time and just watch. And you know, the parents would go upstream or downstream, and then every so often they'd come up. Uh-huh. And they would come up usually from the downstream side, there's a rock in the middle, and you could see all the droppings on the rock that they favored, and they would fly directly from there. Uh-huh. And the young birds, I actually have some video, you know, when they sense the parent coming, of course they get really noisy, and mostly they'll... Most of the time, they were pretty quiet, except for that time, it seemed like. But I didn't ever, like, I'd go watch from time to time, and they were getting bigger, and then you know, it'd be a little bit, and then I'd go back, and they were gone. I would see a young one along in the river somewhere, but they didn't, when I saw them, they didn't seem to be hanging out as a you know, strongly cohesive family group. They may have been, like, aware of where each other were, but I didn't see them all together.
Yeah, it's amazing sometimes how much more work the parents seem to have to do once the fledgies disperse, because they're just up and down the stream, and you can hear the fledgies call as the parents go by, and they got to stop in and drop something off in this mouth and then go get something for that mouth. So when you were seeing them bring food to the nest, were you seeing them bring a lot of fish, or could you tell whether they had aquatic insects or
season, of course, was going to be, it was before any salmon ran upstream, because this was both times I saw them, all the times that I've seen them there, it's relatively early brood, I guess.
Okay.
I don't remember seeing them nest again in the same season there. I think I thought one year that they might, because they were still hanging around, but I don't think that they did. I think they're mostly getting caddisflies and aquatic invertebrates.
Okay.
That's my thinking. I might be able to tell from a couple of the pictures what they were catching, insects, immature ones, adult insects as well.
Yeah, they'll do some fly catching sometimes.
Yeah, but I don't think that there was, I don't think there was small fry in the stream at that time.
Okay.
But I couldn't swear to it.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, because this was May and early June. I think they fledged by...
It's an early nest, yeah.
Yeah, I think they fledged by... I think they were fledged by late June. Mm-hmm. So, I could double check, you know, and get a slightly tighter window on that. But it did seem a little, and that's why I said they probably are getting started there. I mean, it's low elevation and a relatively warm spot. I think that the sun comes around there and reflects up off the water. I kind of wonder if that's why they chose that side. It's maybe a little warmer. The nice thing is it's convenient.
Yeah, totally. I'm sort of a dipper evangelist in terms of watchable wildlife. Dippers are way up there because, you know, they're easy to spot. They're easy to identify. And once you know where a nest is, it's a delight to watch them because you can see them do these great foraging behaviors. If anybody's listening who isn't familiar with dippers, they're aquatic songbirds, and they duck their head. They put the head underwater to look for food, and then they'll dive under the water, and they'll go underwater in foaming torrents. You know, they'll work their way along the bottom. They use their wings to hold them underwater, and they also use their feet, and they pick up aquatic insects, little fish eggs, and eat them themselves and feed them to their chicks. So
I've seen, you know, Bob Armstrong has some really cool
great
videos.
Video,
the GoPro revolution, you know, of,
totally.
of uh, of the dippers underneath, like in a pool, in a river, and you know, you can see them, you know, flying through the water. Really, I think they're using their wings to kind of fly through the water.
Yeah,
it is pretty fascinating. And let's see, I think if you go to was it Nature Bob or
naturebob.com,
and that's his website. Some of the videos there, and then you can find the link to his Vimeo page, which has bunches and bunches of them. He's been doing a lot of videos in recent years. So
yeah, and he recently published a video collection too.
Oh, okay.
That you can, it's, I'm sure the information's on his website to check out, but you can get that from him too.
Okay. Yeah. It's he. I mean, of course, he's been doing so much for so long, just kind of documenting and sharing stuff. Yeah. It's a pretty amazing resource that he has there. So, and dippers are one of the things that he's got some extra nice videos of. So, one of the things I also wanted to talk about, make sure we talk about today, is during your work on the dippers, you, I don't, was it you or maybe a couple of you stumbled on, more or less stumbled on to a marbled murrelet nest?
Almost literally. Yeah. Yeah. This is, Greg Straveler up in Gustavus, I guess, it sort of started, initiated this phrase of, let's see, it's peripheral vision as an adjunct to rigor. Yeah. And this was sort of an extreme example. We were being rigorous in studying our dippers, and we had this, in this peripheral vision, we had this amazing revelation. So we were studying, we were checking nests on a stream out of Juneau, Eagle Creek, over on Douglas, and this was in 2009, I believe. And part of checking nests, we get off the trail, you know, you got to go find a good vantage point to look down and see what's going on at the nest. Are they still feeding chicks? Are the chicks gone? Mary Wilson and I were doing this, and I was a little bit ahead, kind of popped over a little ridge over a fin of rock at the top of a waterfall, and a bird just popped out from below my feet, went across, winging across the canyon, and got a little look at it, could see it was kind of a dark brown with these white flank patches, and about then Mary showed up, and we looked down, and there's a little speckled egg in the moss just down below us, and it's marbled murrelet nest, ground nest at the top of this waterfall. Great spot. They could just hop right off the nest and get airborne because it was about 100-foot falls. And so over the next several weeks, as that nest story progressed, we went back up several times. Bob Armstrong came up with us and took some photos, and we got to watch this nest become successful, actually. We saw the egg. We saw the fuzzy downy chick. We actually witnessed a feeding of the chick one time with an adult, and then we saw the chick with its full flight feather coat, and then the next day it was gone. So we have our fingers crossed, but it had a pretty good chance.
Yeah.
To make it.
Well, and for folks that don't know, marbled murrelets are not highly adapted for, I mean, they're adapted for flying and swimming. So their flight requires, I remember Matt Kirchhoff came and gave a talk here, and this is when I first learned, and there's a nice pamphlet, I don't know if it's still available, that the Fish and Game produced about marbled murrelets that has a lot of this in it. But I remember just being really fascinated the first time when I heard his talk. And I mean, they're one of the birds I remember from when I was a kid. Like, I didn't pay that much attention to birds. I mean, I knew some of them. But I remember those as the birds that we'd be out on the boat, and they just always would just tip. And there was bunches of them, small brown birds. I couldn't have told you what they were, but I have those memories of seeing them. So like they were familiar, and they're common bird, one of the most common birds on the water here year round. And I didn't realize, like he said, I think they have to be flying 43 miles an hour to gain lift. And so you'll see them like bounce off the water as they're trying to take off. They're just trying to get speed. And so, I mean, that's one of the reasons that I guess old growth is considered like what they need, because they need a branch large enough for them to nest on, although in this case they weren't nesting in a tree. But and then they need the gaps to be able to, you know, basically do a J. They fall out of the nest to gain speed, and then because they can't take off from the ground, and then get enough speed and then fly out of these gaps. How they're doing this at night, carrying food, you know, and then the other mystery of like. You you got one chance, essentially. I suppose at a waterfall, maybe you can land on the stream and have a second chance. But
yeah, I guess I've heard stories of chicks that managed to fortunately land in the stream and managed to, you know, work their way down the stream. But yeah, I've talked to people who've had this experience, and I actually remember this happening to me when I was really a small child, hiking on a trail near Juneau, of finding a marbled murrelet chick on the trail. Yeah, and unable to take off. And that's, I've talked to other people who've had that happen too, just seeing them on the ground. And some people have been kind enough to pick them up and move them to the nearest body of water. But other than that, they're pretty much out of luck.
Yeah, I think, you know, there was, if I'm remembering correctly, somebody that did an extensive backcountry hike around here found one, but I think he thought the wing was broken.
Wing damaged, yeah. Mm.
But, you know, well up the valley, it wasn't, but, you know, it could have been one of those things that maybe it wasn't ready to go quite, but it tried anyway and crashed instead of making it to the water. Because it is kind of like, that's a lot to ask, it feels like to me, of a bird that's not super, like, it's not most adapted for flying necessarily. And your first flight, you have to make it.
Yeah, it's not like you can practice. I mean, we watched, actually, the one we were watching, it would stand up. We could see it stand and it would flap its wings and stretch. But of course, that's not going to, you know, it might give it a little sense of what flight is like, but never, it's got to be pure, you know, watching the parent. Okay, they do that. And then just that instinct that's going to.
At some point, you got to just go, I guess.
Sure. And some of them, the first flight is, you know, tens of miles.
Yeah.
You know, they'll nest 30 miles inland, I understand, right?
That's what I remember hearing is that some of them go well inland. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, they're flying pretty fast. It's not the adults. So it's not, like, ridiculous to think that they're making these trips back and forth. But, you know, that's a lot to ask of a first flight, I would think. You know, I was like, let's see. Well, you're going to learn to walk, and your first task is to, you know, run a marathon.
Right.
It's like kind of something like that. It seems like it's kind of interesting thing. But, you know, my understanding is, and maybe you know more details, but my understanding is there's still very few nests that have actually been found of marbled murrelets.
So, yeah, I don't know. Since we found it, ours was one of the first ground nests documented in the Juneau area. And we actually, it was funny, the next year we found two more.
Oh, yeah.
Also while looking for dippers in a completely different stream. So it was just this, all of a sudden, what's going on? But two more ground nests.
The same type of situation?
Same situation, yeah. Top of a tall falls on a little fin or shelf of rock with moss and a few overhanging trees in both cases. Both of them aspects on both are kind of north aspects
of
them, which was interesting.
Do you think it was? Do you think it was like? Was it a very direct, or like a lot of our falls here are falls, but they're like a tumble, or were these like direct? Like,
both of
free
these
falls?
Are pretty vertical. Yeah. There was definitely it was pretty clear that the opening and the drop was a big advantage. And yeah, of course, it seems to me that not only the ability to drop out of the nest and gain that airspeed to get flying, but also the ability to kind of the room to get slowed down from your super high fast coming in hot for the landing to be able to swoop up and lose that speed and stall out and plop
exactly.
down on the nest.
That was the other thing that was funny, and I'd forgotten that part until you just mentioned it again, but yeah, that's how you stop is that you can't go from 43 to nothing in a smooth. You just have to go up and then sort of plop, which is pretty amazing. I mean, I guess they've got it figured out.
Extraordinary little birds.
Yeah, my understanding is their reproductive strategy is, you know, live long time and not necessarily have immense success in any given year, but they're. But they're fairly long-lived birds.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that. How, like, range of years?
Yeah, I can't remember how long they were saying, but essentially the survival rate of, you know, the nesting success rate, I guess, is relatively low. And, you know, some birds will have multiple hatchlings every year. These guys have one per nest. And it's often not successful, I guess, you know, whether that's due to raven or, you know, predators, because if it's on the ground, you know, mink or otter or squirrels even, you know,
definitely
anything like that could find it. Ravens, jays, you know, it's hard to imagine, like, even a nearly fledged juvenile of raven would eat I'm sure.
Sure. Yeah.
Eagle certainly would. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, I guess they're, when they're speckled though, they're pretty, they blend in pretty well.
The chicks, really well camouflaged when they're speckled. When they'd get that juvenile, the flight plumage, they're black and white, and that stood out a little bit more. Plus they're big.
Yeah.
It's a big bird. But yeah, it did amaze me that this little bird, it would have been so easy for a mink to just to nab it, or a raven. And the fact that it had the discipline to stay in that one spot, too.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to be able to walk away or run away. It could fly away, but only after it's ready. So
that's
lucky and good camouflage.
Right. Yeah, and I guess, the parents are often... Well, you said you witnessed a feeding, though, so that must have happened during the day.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting. The parent came in, and Bob actually got a series of photos of it happening, and we weren't sure what was going on at first, because there was sort of this kind of movement, and we're looking at through binoculars, and it was kind of a rainy day. But we could see there was something silver, and there was something brown, and then there was something black and white. And then we realized what was going on was the parent was transferring this fish to this chick.
Yeah.
And apparently that takes a long time sometimes. There's a lot of, I don't know, negotiation, or maybe the chick's really full or whatever. But I've heard that it can take a couple minutes to get the chick to swallow
eat?
The fish. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Maybe they don't like it. Maybe it's an acquired taste.
Right. Try this one. You'll
like it. Well, you know, I wonder, was that... were those in places where, like, you could set up, theoretically, a trail cam or something that would monitor those? Like, some of those
would be
the infrared, you know, they'd go all night.
Sure, gosh, that would be great technology to put. Yeah. This was, I'm sure they existed back then, but none of us had them back then. But that would have been a good spot for a trail cam. Totally.
Yeah. I'm Rolodexing through my mind here of the places around here but most of the places I can think of with falls, actually, they're more cascades, you know. Mm-hmm. It isn't 100-foot drop kind of thing.
At least not the accessible ones
there's plenty of places I've seen that are like that, but I'm not going to be getting to the top of those ones anytime soon. Actually, along Herring Cove Trail, that one's pretty much a straight drop.
Uh-huh.
It might be possible to get to the top
of
that
one. From above somehow.
Yeah, maybe. I think, I might climb up from one side or the other and kind of, I don't know. I don't know how easy it would be. They seem to be fairly well chosen places, I guess, to avoid other folks finding them.
Definitely.
But if anybody out there has seen any nests they do nest in trees as well, I think. It seems like maybe one of the first nests was found on Baranoff Island, and it was in a tree that had fallen down or something on the northeast side of Baranoff Island in a bay up there in the 70s, I think, that they found one in a tree.
Hmm.
And I don't think it was a tree that was cut down, but I don't remember, actually. That was one of the first nests that – because they just weren't sure what was going on.
Yeah, I think I heard in California, I guess, in Oregon, loggers apparently kind of had a sense that they were tree nesting, because they called them fog larks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, because their calls are pretty distinctive. And I know that in Juneau, they year-round would be recorded. I just had a recorder set up out my window, like a parabolic dish, and just would let it go all night.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the year, I also would catch
year.
Recordings of them flying over.
Okay.
In the middle of winter, even.
Huh.
And they would fly over, and sometimes you'd hear them fly over, and it was probably the same ones flying back a couple minutes later, so they're just like doing these inland loops for some reason.
Did it sound like maybe duetting calls, like two of them calling together?
It often sound like more than one, not always, but it often did sound like more than one, and maybe even more than two. I don't know. It was also interesting to me. I'm not sure if this is what was going on, but it sure sounded like it a couple of times that they would fly over and then the river otters would chirp.
Whoa, huh.
And so it's almost like that the river otters were responding to the murrelets flying over. I don't know. But I remember when I first started doing it, I wasn't sure what I was hearing.
Uh-huh.
And so I would hear these calls that were sort of vaguely gull-like, and then I would hear these chirping calls, and I wasn't sure at that time what those were either.
Huh?
And eventually I got to be able to, they were kind of similar, you know, but eventually I was able to tell apart the chirps that were the river otters. From, you know, this time, at that time, I lived behind the Sheldon Jackson Museum, kind of up on the hill there, and my dish was pointed kind of towards Indian River, in Indian River Valley. So the river otters, I think, were along the flume that runs through Sheldon Jackson campus.
Okay.
And then the murrelets were just flying over, probably up Indian River Valley. But I don't know. I mean, it just, it was an interesting yeah. question. And I guess, yeah, maybe they heard him. They're like, we hear you. I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder how much, you know, interspecies communication goes on that we are totally unaware of. It's got to be. They hear each other. They've got to understand, learn
Something.
To understand
yeah.
what the other species is, what that means anyway,
right.
what that predicts.
Yeah. You know, in terms of like, I was talking a little earlier about bird language, I think definitely, like, if you have a shared predator, like one thing that I saw happen, and I don't know why, but I was down at Totem Park once, and I heard a squirrel give a call that I don't actually ever remember hearing any other time. And it was just like three or four chit-chit-chit-chit notes, and that was all. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there. I wasn't doing anything different. And I was watching a song sparrow just kind of forage in the – it was in the kind of the grasses. It was late winter. And so just the stuff that had washed like in the highest tides of the year had kind of gotten caught. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of poking around in there. But as soon as that squirrel did that, it like flew immediately back into cover and it just sat there and it watched and I was like, that's interesting.
Sure.
You know, I don't know, but like, what would a, you know, around here common predator might be some sort of hawk, you know, maybe a goshawk. I don't know if goshawks go after squirrels at all
yeah,
or not.
Good question. It seems like they might.
yeah or a red-tailed hawk or maybe a mink or something, I guess. I don't know what squirrels are worried about. But yeah, it was just interesting, you know, like part of it, I guess, is just spending enough time out paying attention and starting to, you know, piece together these stories and then talk to other people that happen to notice. And then, you know, you kind of start to at least build hypotheses, you know, even if they're not anything conclusive.
Sure. Yeah. Making the connections. You have to be out in the patterns enough to notice when the pattern shifts or breaks or even find the pattern. Yeah, that murrelet and otter. You're making me really intrigued.
Well,
that's,
you know, it's just the similar quality of sound. And I just wondered if it was like, you know, not necessarily anything super communicative,
but
just like the, you know, the dogs that howl with the siren kind of thing. It's just like, oh, yeah, I hear this, so I'm going to contribute my voice to the calling, too. But, you know, I mean, it had to, there was lots of times when the murrelets went over and I never heard any otters. And of course, there may not have been any otters there in the first place. So, but there was just a couple of times at least where it was enough of a, they just seemed to be coincident that like it could have been a coincidence, but it might have also been that the otters were responding to the murrelets.
So have you listened to other otter vocalizations? I'm curious about what you've learned about.
I mostly just heard the chirping. I don't know what other calls that otter. I think that they make other calls, but I've not heard a lot. I don't hang out a lot where otters hang out, I guess, or at least at the times that they hang out there. And the chirping is so loud. That's the one that I've noticed. I think mink might chirp too, but I haven't heard them so much.
Yeah.
I don't think they are in the same way as otters. I've heard mink sort of hiss, I guess, a little bit. Mink are a little intimidating.
They are.
Despite being small.
They have a lot of presence.
Yes, they do. I happened upon one that was a little ticked off at an eagle. I saw it walk across. It was actually down at Totem Park, and it kind of walked across. It was carrying something, and at first I thought it was like a little kit. I didn't know what it was. It was just a little brown thing in its mouth, and I thought, oh, maybe it's moving its kit around or something. And it went around the corner, and later I think I decided it was probably actually what it was, probably as a winter wren. It was really small, so it probably caught a little wren. And it went around the corner, and I couldn't see it, but this eagle comes just flying in, you know, just gliding in, and I hear this like shh, you know, going on over there. And then the eagle flies back, and it's got this little tiny thing in its claws. And I was like, oh, it went over there. And so I walked around to where it was, and there's these kind of rocks, you know, that had been put in on a to stabilize an embankment there to keep the river from eroding it out. And the mink was kind of in those rocks. And as I walked up, it, like, was coming out, and it was sort of, like, you know, lunging at me a little bit. And I was like, Okay.
You know, frustration.
Yeah, I was very frustrated, I think. You know, it's one of those things, like, it was really ticked off at this eagle. But, I mean, what was it going to do? Because the eagle could, if the eagle got it, it probably, you know, would have been the end of that. So, but it was kind of, like, what puzzled me in part was that why would the eagle bother with this tiny little, like, a wren? It's less than a bite for an eagle, I'm sure.
Sure. And good point.
It went over there, grabbed it.
Maybe it went for the mink, and the mink dropped the wren, and the eagle figured, well, I can get this.
Get something.
You get something out of it.
Huh? Yeah, it was kind of it was an interesting little thing there. And I was like, you know, mink, I don't think you could do a huge amount of damage to me, but I'm still intimidated. That's
you know,
how I felt.
I had the same experience with weasels, actually, spring. And we've had this, really, it seems like a lot of weasel activity. Mm-hmm. Now, I haven't lived in Gustavus for long, but it feels like a lot to me. And I've talked to people, other people who said it feels like more weasel activity they're seeing. And it may be tied to the fact we're seeing more voles.
Yeah.
We're maybe kind of at the tail end of a vole cycle. And there was a weasel that had a nest of kits in this outbuilding of a place we were renting. And we watched her at one point. We watched her move her kits, which was really interesting. But I would go in there to get something out of the outbuilding, and I could hear her under my feet moving back and forth, making lots of sounds. And I moved fast, you know.
Yes.
And I don't know what I thought she would do. I suppose she could bite. They have nice sharp teeth, but climb up your pants. Yeah. I don't know, but she might have.
Yeah.
They have a lot of a lot of presence for such a small animal.
Yes. It is kind of funny how they are able to communicate that so effectively, despite the size difference. That, like, I don't care that you're big, I will still take you.
I suppose it might be called, but you know, some description might be called the aura of this animal, this sort of layer of energy
and that's why, you know, I've never seen a wolverine, but as you know, I've heard that wolverines are, like, they're the biggest of that family, and they carry that, but even more so because they're actually not, I mean, they're not huge, but they're not tiny either. Mm-hmm. And so, I've heard some stories about wolverines that basically you avoid messing with them at all if you can help it. They take that intimidation to a whole other level.
Yeah.
So, well, we've been talking for almost an hour, so I should, you know, if there's anything else that you'd like to mention before we wrap up here.
It's been a great conversation, though. I always love to talk natural history. It's interesting, too, to me to come to Sitka from Gustavus, because it's even more strongly different to come here than to come here from Juneau.
Oh, you know, really?
The habitats in Gustavus are so different, and I'm just learning them. But even the phenology is different. You know, right now, probably we might be having a few salmonberry buds opening, but here they just seem to be all popping so vigorously. So
That's not typical, I might say.
Well,
this year has been, it just never got cold. It's really, like, a lot of we've had warm winters, but we had a cold snap that seems to at least reset the clock a little bit, but not this year. So I've been a little, I was concerned earlier. Now I'm less so. I don't think we're going to get a deep freeze now that kills things.
I wonder too. In fact, this may be the year you might see two broods for the dippers on Indian River. I mean, if any year, this seems like be the one to keep an eye on that nest.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the, you know, I appreciate you coming in. It is fun to talk about, you know, find out. I'm sort of obsessed about Sitka natural history stuff, and it is interesting to get a sense of it a little bit from the contrast of how it differs from nearby locations, you know. And Gustavus, I imagine, is strongly influenced by the, you know, the glaciers that are still around there and the foreland, you know, habitat. It's just
flats. It's kind of an exciting place to be a naturalist there, just because it's so new and it's changing so fast.
Yeah.
You know, the forelands are an uplifted outwash, glacial outwash plain that really started forming, you know, or finished forming, I should say, 350 years ago. The face of the glacier is literally right there, and then a bunch of it's been uplifted from the ocean since then. So, you know, you have this incredibly rapid succession of, you know, beech meadows and then, in, you know, willow thickets and spruce forest coming up, and then of course you got moose in the mix now, and so it's a really exciting place and very different.
Yeah, it sounds like a fun place to get to know a little better.
And, yeah, definitely.
You know, lots of stuff going on there. But thanks for coming in and taking some time out of your trip here. And yeah, maybe we next time you come visit, we can visit again.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Come visit in Gustavus.
Yeah. Well, someday I might make it up there. It'd be fun to see Glacier Bay. I've never seen Glacier Bay.
It's worth seeing.
Yeah. I've heard good things. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation with Kathy Hawker that I originally recorded and aired back in the spring of 2016. I'd like to thank her again for taking some time to visit with me and share her enthusiasm for art and the natural world. And thank you for joining me here this week on the Sitka Nature Show. As always, you can find recordings of past shows at sitkanature.org/raven or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there in this summer season. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com. And until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.